You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for September 29th. I'm Elena from Drake University. Here's our first story. So we have an image of a group of cheerleaders, and the caption says, "Nearly 300 attend walk to end Alzheimer's." The Thomas Jefferson High School dance team entertains during the registration period before the walk to end Alzheimer's on Saturday, September 24th, 2022 at the River's Edge Pavilion. Almost 300 people participated in the local walk, which is part of an international event that is the world's largest fundraiser held to fight Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. The Alzheimer's Association has invested more than $310 million in research, critical care, education, and advocacy for Alzheimer's. Jessica Duncan, chair of the local Walk to End Alzheimer's, speaks during a ceremony held before the walk began Saturday, September 24th, 2022, at the River's Edge Pavilion. Duncan said $36,000 had already been raised by local teams and individuals, and fundraising will continue until December. In addition, national corporate sponsors Edward Jones and CVS Health are donating $5 million this year and $10 million over 3 years, respectively. And we have two images to the left, one of a group of people walking with their dog with the caption, "Walkers step off on the walk to end Alzheimer's." And then we also have another image of a woman reading a speech. Our next story, Carson and Minden pitch wish lists. Then the subheading says, "Latest cities to present needs for county ARPA funding," by David Golbitz. Representatives from Carson and Minden are the latest small town officials to present their community's infrastructure wish list to the Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors for consideration of receiving American Rescue Plan funds. Over the last few weeks, the county board has been meeting with city officials from throughout the county to assess their town's needs for financial assistance with infrastructure projects. The board set aside $1.5 million in ARPA funds to distribute to the county's cities outside of Council Bluffs. At the September 27th board meeting, Carson Administrative Clerk Brianne Dued and Assistant EMS Chief Adam Hay laid out a number of projects that would benefit from funding assistance, including a new ambulance for their first responders. The current ambulance is 12 years old and it has seen a lot of wear and tear due to the pandemic. "We try to get a new ambulance every 10 to 12 years," Duet said. "With the pandemic, that was the most utilized local resource we had." In addition to Carson, the ambulance also serves nearby communities in Oakland, Macedonia, and Henderson. Out of 194 total emergency calls for an ambulance in 2021, 99 were from Carson and 83 were from Oakland, with the remaining 12 calls split between Henderson and Macedonia. This year, as of September 8th, Carson has had 65 calls for the ambulance, with 47 from Oakland and 17 from the surrounding area. "Usually pretty close to half of our calls are outside of the city," Hay said. The Carson Fire Department accepted a bid for a new ambulance of $281,581. The city authorized the use of $120,000 of its own ARPA funds, leaving a balance of $161,581. "That's our main goal," Duet said. "It would most definitely support our community, and it supports the local communities because we do provide a lot of mutual aid assistance." Other projects on the Carson wish list include the demolition of two derelict buildings, which will help with the city's downtown revitalization efforts, as will the installation of new water and sewer mains, sidewalks, and storm drainage along Broadway Boulevard, water and sewer service for a new 13-acre business park, and additional infrastructure for a group of residential lots that are currently for sale. The city of Carson would also like to purchase a new fire engine by 2024, for which it has applied for a series of grants. Minden Mayor Kevin Zimmerman and Councilman Glenn Hurst touted a few infrastructure projects that have been completed recently, including replacing the city's water tower and redoing the downtown area. "As you know, in a small town, there's all kinds of projects," Zimmerman said. "You just got to pick the ones you can do." Current projects that could use some ARPA assistance include replacing a 3-block stretch of water main, 5 blocks of water and sewer replacement, and general infrastructure wear and tear like road and sewer repairs. The city of Minden is also purchasing a little more than 45 acres of land north of town in preparation for potential growth. The city has created a foundation to help facilitate construction on the land and needs $125,000 to $150,000 for a starter fund, which they hope will be matched by a grant from the Iowa West Foundation. "Everything we've done, the water tower, everything, is set up for another 100-plus houses," Zimmerman said. We're poised for a lot of growth in our little town, Supervisor Brian Shea said. All of them. The board will continue to hear proposals from the remaining small town representatives over the next couple of weeks, and then deliberate on which projects they have decided will receive a portion of the ARPA funds. Board Chairman Tim Wickman has said that each community will receive ARPA funds for at least one of their infrastructure projects. We will be back in touch with you as soon as we've compiled the information and the board's made a call, Wickman told the Carson and Minden representatives. And our next story, new opioid funding to help hundreds of Iowans. Millions more also headed to Iowa from opioid legal settlements, by Tom Barton. State public health officials say more than 1,000 Iowans struggling with opioid addiction would be served by expanded access to treatment and recovery support services under new federal funding. The Iowa Department of Health and Human Services will receive $9 million in a state opioid response money as part of $1.5 billion in nationwide funding announced last week by the White House to help states, territories, and tribes combat the nation's opioid epidemic. The funding also allows states to invest in better overdose education and increase the accessibility of Food and Drug Administration-approved naloxone products used to help reverse an opioid overdose, according to the White House. The Iowa Department of Health and Human Services estimates at least 1,100 Iowans will receive treatment and/or recovery support services during the 2 years of the grant funding, with an additional 11,000 Iowans receiving prevention and/or harm reduction services. Continued media efforts will reach even more through a variety of campaigns aiming to reduce stigma and inform Iowans about the risks associated with the opioid crisis, Iowa Department of Health and Human Services Public Information Officer Sarah Ekstrand said in an email. Although Iowa is considered a low-incidence state compared to many others, the increases in opioid-related deaths are concerning. Last year, 258 Iowans died of opioid overdoses, up from 157 deaths in 2019 and 213 deaths in 2002, according to the State Health and Human Services Department. About 83% of those deaths involve fentanyl or other synthetic narcotics. Increasing instances of these synthetics being detected in combination with other drugs such as stimulants indicate that some people who think they are taking something other than an opioid are also dying due to contamination of those substances with illicit fentanyl, Ekstrand wrote. The recently announced award comes as a follow-up to previous opioid grants and will allow for continuation and expansion of the prevention, treatment, and recovery efforts in the state. Additionally, Ekstrand said that the department's staff has been working closely with the Iowa Attorney General's office to coordinate efforts on ways to use money from legal settlements with opioid makers. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller has joined multiple lawsuits across the nation alleging drug manufacturers deceptively marketed opioids and contributed to the opioid addiction crisis. Several companies have settled in those cases. The biggest chunk of money will come from settlements with opioid maker Johnson & Johnson and the nation's three major pharmaceutical distributors, Cardinal, McKesson, and AmerisourceBergen. Over the course of 18 years, Iowa expects to receive $177.74 million from those two settlements combined. The money will be split evenly between the state and counties and cities. Under the settlement, the money must be used for opioid abatement, including prevention, treatment, and recovery, according to the Attorney General's office. Iowa's portion of a combined $6.6 billion nationwide settlement with opioid makers Allergan and Teva Pharmaceuticals has not yet been determined, said Lynn Hicks, chief of staff for Miller. And other settlements with opioid makers, most notably Purdue Pharma, remain outstanding. A settlement and bankruptcy plan with Purdue, the maker of OxyContin, is before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. The Iowa Attorney General's office has reached an agreement in principle with Ireland-based pharmaceutical company Endo International, with other cases under litigation or negotiation that the office said it could not disclose. The White House announcement was great news and bring much-needed resources into the state, Hicks said in an email. We will continue to coordinate with the State Health and Human Services Department as these new dollars arrive. Hicks said money from Johnson & Johnson and the distributors have started to be distributed to the state and its counties. The office has also received money from the McKinsey settlement, reached in February 2021. A portion was used to launch opioidhelp.iowa.gov, a dashboard that allows Iowans to find locations to seek treatment from providers that have contracted with the state. Last year, the Iowa Attorney General's office signed an agreement with University of Iowa Healthcare to develop a comprehensive statewide opioid treatment program using $3.8 million in settlement funds. Rod Courtney of CRUSH, Community Resources United to Stop Heroin, of Iowa called the White House announcement of the funding encouraging, in particular, a planned $104 million investment to expand prevention services for substance use disorder in rural communities. The federal funding will allow states to increase investments in overdose education, peer support specialists in emergency departments, and other strategies, Courtney said, that can help save lives in hard-hit communities. The Cedar Rapids-based not-for-profit provides support, resources, education, and referrals for individuals with substance use disorders. Crush opened a peer-led recovery community center in June in Cedar Rapids Human Services building downtown. The drop-in center uses a peer-centered approach that promotes recovery through support groups and services, advocacy, outreach, and treatment and resource referrals. All right, our next article, $4.9 million contract awarded. Project will renovate Canesville Learning Center. And we have a photo of a building with a sign that says Canesville Alternative Learning Center. The caption under this photo says, the Council Bluffs Community School District Board of Education on Tuesday awarded a $4.9 million contract to Midwest DCM of Omaha for the Canesville Learning Center renovation project. The Council Bluffs Community School District Board of Education on Tuesday awarded a contract to Midwest DCM of Omaha for the Canesville Learning Center renovation project. Canesville is housed in the former Washington Elementary School building at 207 Scott Street. Midwest submitted a bid of $4,965,000, the lowest of four received on the project. The bid includes one alternate to remove the stage/platform in the gym and update the finishes in that space as specified. In addition, Midwest is the contractor for the Early Learning Center, and we're happy with what they've done so far on that, said Daryl Meyer, project manager for the district, during a Board of Education meeting Tuesday. DLR Group is the architecture firm for the project. The renovation will be funded by some of the district's remaining elementary and secondary school emergency relief money, revenue from the Secure and Advanced Vision for Education 1 cent sales tax, and up to $1 million from the sale of the Madison campus last fall, Superintendent Vicky Murillo said. The project will include moving the main entrance to the doors on the southwest corner of the building, relocating offices to that area, and creating a secure entryway that funnels visitors through the office. A room on the lower level will be converted into the cafeteria, and some classrooms will be moved. A new elevator will be installed in the building, and the lower level of the south stairway will be widened. Because the three-story building has levels between floors, the elevator will have doors on both ends to serve each level. New restrooms will be added, and existing restrooms will be made handicap accessible. Preliminary plans included creation of a new teacher's lounge. Furnishings, flooring, and paint will be updated. Outside, basketball hoops will be added to the playground area, and part of the playground will be resurfaced. We're also converting part of the playground on the north side into a parking area, which will have 40 stalls, Meyer said. The parking lot across the street from the front of the building, which has about 9 stalls, will be repaved, sidewalks will be re-poured or repaired, and the retaining wall will be rebuilt. The school's brick exterior walls will be repaired as needed, and new landscaping will be added. Work is expected to begin this week and be substantially complete by June 30th, 2023, according to board materials. The building is scheduled to reopen in July 2023. Canesville students are currently attending classes at the 9th Avenue School, which has been used by the Heartland Family Service Therapeutic School in recent years to clear the way for the renovation project. Students from the Therapeutic School are attending Heartland's Omaha program this school year, but remain under the supervision of the Council Bluffs Community School District. The title of our next article is An Iowa Senate Race, Differing Visions for Agriculture, by Caleb McCullough. Every couple weeks during the summer, U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, a longtime Republican incumbent seeking re-election, takes to Twitter standing in front of his new Hartford cornfield and gives an update on the crop's progress. The Democratic candidate for the seat, retired Admiral Mike Franken, has touted his time growing up on a family farm near Sioux City, standing in front of a cornfield for multiple ads and sporting a blue Navy cap. In Iowa, the leading producer of corn and pork and second highest soybean producer in the country, agriculture is an ever-present issue in political campaigns. This year, U.S. Senate candidates deliver different visions for federal agriculture policies, and both are angling themselves as the best representative for Iowa's farmers. Grassley is one of two crop farmers in the U.S. Senate, along with Democrat John Tester of Montana, which he said gives him a key insight into the needs of farmers. On his home farm, he purchases half the seed and input materials, and his son Robin shoulders the other half. Franken's vision of farming, he said, is one where younger people can easily enter the field and smaller farms flourish, where diverse crops are grown on Iowa's soil, and where farming is done with net zero or negative carbon emissions. Our subheading says small farmers. Franken contends that Grassley has presided over the consolidation of the farming industry, as Iowa's number of farms has fallen and the average size of a farm has increased over the past decades. I would advocate for policies that give our farmers the best chance to be standalone viable producers, where their expertise and their human capital involvement and their farming expertise provides them that standard of living that they so much need, Franken said in an interview. In a recent ad, Franken said Grassley has passed laws that help large agribusinesses squeeze out the little guy. Franken said the market and industry makes it difficult for people to begin farming as the farming population gets older. It's also difficult for farmers to start on a small plot of land as the market is designed for large producers, he said. The markets are such that there's not a crop you can begin on a micro scale that you can make a living on, Franken said. So there needs to be something new, and Grassley is just not a purveyor of bright ideas. Iowa's number of farms has decreased over the past several decades, according to U.S. Department of Agriculture data. The state had 184,000 farms in 1960, and farms were already declining at that time. By 2000, Iowa had 95,000 farms, and in 2010, it had 92,400 farms. In the most recent report, Iowa had 84,900 farms, with an average size of 359 acres. Grassley said he supported policies that help small farmers, including putting a limit on how much farmers can receive from federal subsidies and advocating for cattle transparency bills that he says would allow smaller cattle producers to compete with larger operations. I'm the only farmer in this race, so I think that speaks to the fact that I'm in a good place to represent farmers, Grassley said in an interview. Grassley boasts endorsements from the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation and the Iowa Corn Growers Association, something his campaign points to show he has support from farmers. In a call with reporters this month, former Iowa Farm Bureau President Craig Hill said Grassley has been a frequent advocate of agriculture throughout his career, including pushing for increased research, renewable fuels, and trade. Hill said Grassley has pushed policies that help small-scale farmers, including some that aren't in line with the National Farm Bureau, like caps on federal payments to large-scale farmers. He always is seeking a limit on the payments that go to farmers to protect the small farmer and not help the largest operator be more competitive, Hill said. Grassley has pursued bills with the goal of improving transparency in the cattle industry. One bill would require a certain percentage of cattle to be brought on more open markets, while another proposes the creation of a special investigator into competition among meatpackers. The big four meatpackers have a cozy relationship with the big feedlots of Texas and Kansas, and it squeezes out the independent producer in Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota from getting a fair market, Grassley said. Under the new subheading Environment, as the USDA puts a spotlight and funding behind climate-smart commodities in an effort to reduce the greenhouse gases created by agriculture, Franken said farmers can be a part of the solution to climate change. Farmland can be used to set up solar grazing operations, he said, where livestock graze on land that also houses solar arrays. We've got farmland in this state, and the farmers are the first to say, yes, that's true, that should not be in row crops. They should be in something else, he said. Carbon dioxide captured from agriculture-related operations can also be used for local manufacturing of things like aircraft fuel, he said. Carbon dioxide captured from agriculture-related operations can also be used for local manufacturing of things like aircraft fuel, he said, rather than being shipped out of state and underground. I want a pure, fabulous future for farming, and I foresee an opportunity where Iowa can be the first state in the nation that's a net carbon negative. Farmers are hand in glove with the environmental concerns of the future, he said. Grassley has pitched ethanol as one way to lower carbon emissions while bolstering Iowa's corn industry and creating jobs for rural Iowa. He has supported the renewable fuel standard, which requires oil refineries to blend a certain percentage of renewable fuels into gasoline. The environmental impact of ethanol is debated, but a study from early this year found that ethanol likely creates more carbon emissions than gasoline when factoring in the land used to grow corn and other factors. The Renewable Fuels Association said the study was flawed, and the study's authors precariously string together a series of worst-case assumptions. Grassley said he was the number one person recognized by the ethanol industry as an advocate for the 46,000 jobs we have in Iowa in biofuels and what that does for the corn and soybean prices, to keep them strong. Grassley and Franken will have their first debate next Thursday, October 6th, on Iowa PBS at 7 p.m., The general election for state and federal offices is on November 8th, and early voting begins October 19th. On to our next article titled Face of the Day, we have a picture of a happy-looking dog with the subheading blue. Blue is a 6-year-old neutered male pit bull terrier mix who simply loves to be loved. Blue is looking for a family to share his love with as he's up for adoption at Midlands Humane Society. This friendly and affectionate boy is also loyal and curious. His favorite pastimes include getting belly scratches, giving kisses, and impressing you with his cool tricks like sit and high five. He has successfully lived with children and other dogs, but MHS recommends doing a dog introduction in person before adoption. Blue is part of the ongoing adoption special at Midlands Humane Society and has a reduced fee of $50 in hopes of finding his new home. As MHS experiences a high volume of cats and dogs, select dogs are available for $50, cats over a year old are $50, and kittens under a year are $100. The fee covers microchip, age-appropriate vaccines, and spaying or neutering. Blue must be adopted outside Council Bluffs city limits due to the breed ban. Blue is ready to meet his future family, and potential adopters can visit him at 1020 Railroad Ave. Hours are Monday through Friday from noon to 6 p.m. and Saturday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. MHS can be reached at 712-396-2270, Midlands Humane Society, no spaces, at gmail.com, or at midlandshumanesociety.org. Our next article is titled New Report, Oil Spills from Offshore Transportation Way Down, by Janet McConaughey. We have a photo of a group of people wearing neon vests cleaning up what looks like trash on a beach. And the caption says, workers in protective suits clean the contaminated beach October 7th, 2021 in Corona del Mar after an oil spill in Newport Beach, California. Oil and natural gas spills from tankers and pipelines in U.S. waters dropped dramatically from the last decade of the 1900s to the one from 2010 through 2019, according to a federal report Wednesday. The amounts spilled and dumped in wastewater from drilling rigs and production platforms rose, but if the disastrous 2010 Gulf of Mexico spill isn't counted, the increase is mainly because there is more work offshore, said the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. It is evident that regulatory changes, advances in science and technology, and, for the most part, attention to safety would have helped to make North American waters less polluted with oil, without the Deepwater Horizon spill, the report said. But the BP well blew, killing 11 people and spewing millions of gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico off Louisiana over months. Another big contributor during the past decade was the nation's longest-running oil spill, also off Louisiana. The 497-page report was written by an international committee of academic and industry experts and reviewed by many others. Overall, I think they've done a very comprehensive job, said Anthony Knapp, director of the Geochemical and Environmental Research Group at Texas A&M University, who was not an author or reviewer. Like a report released in 2003, this one, Oil in the Sea 4, Inputs, Fates, and Effects, said oil and runoff, largely from cars and cities, is the biggest source of ocean oil pollution, with natural seeps second and spills in third place. But hard data on oil in rivers is so scarce, and the range of possible amounts so huge that, although the report put the figure from the U.S. about 20 times the earlier estimate, it couldn't say whether there was an actual increase. Increases in urban land area, population, and vehicle ownership make an increase plausible, but it is unclear by how much, the report said. One of the big findings is, in general, we do not have adequate data, report committee chair Kersey K. Tika of Ardmore Shipping and Pacific Basin Shipping said in a phone interview Tuesday from London. Natural seeps of oil and natural gas from the ocean floor were estimated at nearly 30.8 million gallons a year. That's about 60% of the 1990s estimate, but the change is because recent estimates of seeps in the Gulf of Mexico and off California are more accurate, Tika said. We have more techniques to measure the seeps, but those two areas are the only ones with data, she said. The spill data is the most accurate part of the report, Tika said. As you probably know, even on large oil spills, you never have exact numbers, she added, but those are the best we have available. Spills from tanker ships fell from an average of 1.6 million gallons a year in the last decade of the 1900s to 61,600 gallons in the decade just past. Over the same period, pipeline spills went from nearly 585,000 gallons a year to just under 117,000 gallons. Laws and regulations after the Exxon Valdez ran aground in 1989 near its namesake Alaska town account for much of the difference in tanker spills, Tika said. Among other things, she noted, the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 phased in a requirement for double-hulled tankers in U.S. waters, and other countries and international bodies followed suit. Increased inspection and maintenance accounts for the reduction in pipeline spills, she said. Spills from offshore oil drilling and production rose sevenfold over the period to about 338,600 gallons a year. And oil and well wastewater was estimated at about 2 million gallons a year, about 2.5 times the estimate for the 1990s. The wastewater oil is likely an overestimate, Tika said. Oil companies report the total amount of produced water, but not the amount of oil it held, so the report used the highest allowable percentage. Most likely the levels are less, she said, adding that both figures reflect increased drilling and production. Without Deepwater Horizon, Tika said in an email, spillage per unit of production has decreased by 65% since the last report, but remained relatively constant in the last 20 years. Texas A&M's Knapp said in an email, just like discharges from ships, operators are far more diligent than they were in the past, so a straight line from number to platforms to more oil is not a given. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for September 29th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Elena from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. We're moving on to the lifestyle section with our first article titled Autumnal Arrivals, 5 books from debut authors worth keeping on your radar by Crystal Paul. Although spring may be the herald of newness and renewal, fall boasts other beginnings, the inevitable return of pumpkin spice, the launch of new TV shows, and, of course, a slew of new books to read. To double up on the new and breathe some new life into the season usually associated with decay, we rounded up some of the best books by debut authors making their mark this fall. 1. What We Fed to the Manticore by Talia Lakshmi Kaluri. From the melting Arctic to the bomb-ridden Gaza Strip, this debut collection from Talia Lakshmi Kaluri tells stories of human suffering, connection, and cruelty, but it tells them through the voices of animals. A hound at a wildlife sanctuary charged with protecting rhinos, a starving tiger in the Sundarbans, a donkey at a zoo in Gaza, a polar bear watching as his world melts around him. All of Kaluri's stories are taken from real-life events around the world, sometimes mixing together different stories, myths, and tragedies. Though each story is told by and from the perspectives of the animals, you can't help but see the human imprint in each of them. We are there in the background. This collection lays bare the inextricable human-animal connection. We live here in this terrible, beautiful, ruthless, and harmonious world together, and we share in the life and death, suffering, and triumph of it all. 2. White Horse by Erica T. Worth. Let's not forget that fall is also the time of spirits, Dia de los Muertos, and things that go bump in the night, Halloween. Erica T. Worth's major publisher debut, White Horse, doesn't forget it. Equal parts horror and magical realism with a noir edge, you can practically smell the cigarette smoke and stale whiskey seeping from the pages as easily as you can feel the hair standing up on the back of your own neck as the heroine faces screaming ghosts, creeping shadows, and a monster that smells of human flesh. A monster that's rarely made itself known outside of indigenous communities. But there's more to it than the supernatural. There on the page's edge is the very real horror story of the thousands of missing and murdered indigenous women in the United States, Canada, and Latin America. Of Apache, Chickasaw, and Cherokee descent and raised outside of Denver, Worth also draws on her own upbringing to bring a raw realism to her depictions of urban indigenous life in the West. 3. Daughters of the New Year by E.M. Tran. A haunted journey through a family's history, Daughters of the New Year travels from present-day New Orleans and the unique experiences of 3 second-generation Vietnamese-American daughters back through their matrilineal line and across the Atlantic to the Vietnam War and colonial and pre-colonial Vietnam. The way is guided by specters of Vietnamese women past as the three daughters and their mother, Juan, spelled X-U-A-N, seem to become ghosts themselves the further you read into their ancestry. As their history becomes apparent to the reader, the women remain in the dark about their ancestors' lives, making the reader feel much more keenly how much was lost through colonization, war, racism, and displacement. 4. The Mountain and the Sea by Ray Naylor. Remember the not-so-brief preoccupation with zombies and vampires in the early 2010s? Well, I think we have a new combo to capture our imaginations, androids and octopuses. That's right, Ray Naylor's debut novel sends the world's first android a few leagues under the sea to break bread with a newly discovered and rapidly proliferating species of highly intelligent octopuses that may have developed their own language and culture. Given that octopuses have, in reality, proven to be quite intelligent, and given our increasingly robotized and intelligent computerized society, one can hope that this debut from a former Foreign Service officer and soon-to-be advisor to the Office of Marine Sanctuaries will have a lot to say about what happens when humans are no longer the planet's smartest species. And our last book, number 5, Mother Brain, How Neuroscience is Rewriting the Story of Parenthood, by Chelsea Conaboy. Yes, I'm a mom of a toddler and have one on the way, so I'm interested in a book about the legitimate science behind the thinly veiled insult/excuse of mom brain. I also happen to have a degree in behavioral neuroscience, so this book basically looks like candy to me. As a demographic that is often trivialized, minimized, and outright forgotten about in society, mothers deserve a book that takes a look at the science of how making a person with your body fundamentally changes your brain. With a fair amount of disinformation out there, here's hoping we can see a good amount of myth-busting in this debut from journalist, public health enthusiast, and mother Chelsea Conaboy. Now going to be moving on to the obituaries. Jean Ethelyn Blackburn is our first obituary today. Jean Ethelyn Blackburn, the daughter of Everett Zachariah and Ethel Florence Miller Plum, passed away September 25, 2022, in West Des Moines, Iowa, at the age of 90 years. Jean was preceded in death by her husband, her parents, her brothers, Richard Plum Dorothy, Paul Plum, George Shorty Plum, and sister Flo Klingman Eldon. She was also preceded in death by her brothers-in-law, William G. Blackburn, Carol Max Blackburn, Zilpha, and sister-in-law, Eleanor Blackburn. She is survived by her daughters, Lorna Blackburn of Red Oak and Sharon Nyquist Steve of West Des Moines, her grandchildren, Ryan Huss Shonda of Macedonia, Iowa, Melanie Huss of Red Oak, Iowa, Stephanie Rach Alex of West Des Moines, Iowa, and Brett Nyquist of Grimes, Iowa. She is also survived by her great-grandchildren Michael and Nicholas Huss, Emma and Max Wingert, and Theodore and Augustus Raish, her sisters-in-law, Jeanette Plum, Grace Blackburn, and brother-in-law, Bruce Blackburn, Jeanette, and many nieces and nephews. A funeral service will be held on Friday, September 30th, 2022, at 11 a.m. at the Oakland United Methodist Church in Oakland, Iowa. Visitation with the family will be 1 hour prior to the funeral service. Interment will be in Oaklawn Cemetery. Our next obituary of the day is Wanda Leaders. Wanda Leaders, age 96, passed away peacefully at Bethany Heights, September 27, 2022. She was born August 12, 1926, to the late Henry and Bessie Schrader Volkers in Bloomfield, Nebraska. Wanda was a member of Broadway United Methodist Church. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her husband, Wayne Leaders, son, Robert Leaders, siblings, Helen Volkers, Ward Volkers, Velda Jacobs, Verlin Jacobs, and Hazel Freebose, granddaughter, Jamie Leaders, great-grandson, Caleb Robert Davis. Wanda is survived by her children, Steve Marge Leaders, Kathy Wayne Fober, Dean Vicky Leaders, and Shirley Peters Smith. Daughter-in-law, Carol Leaders, 11 grandchildren, and 20 great-grandchildren, a host of other family and friends. Visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Sunday, October 2nd, 2022. Funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. at Broadway United Methodist Church on Monday, October 3rd, 2022. Interment is in Cedar Lawn Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to Broadway United Methodist Church. We'll now begin our sports section. This is the prep volleyball section, and our first article is titled Falcons Jackets Fall in Sweeps by Peter Huguenin. Clarinda defeated St. Albert at home on Tuesday night after finishing with 33 kills as a team. St. Albert junior Ella Klusman led the Saints with 7 assists. Klusman, junior Georgie Bonet, and junior Caitlin Kendricks all tallied 6 kills. Sophomore Ellie Monahan totaled 35 digs. St. Albert is now 10-15 on the season. Thomas Jefferson lost at home on Tuesday after allowing Sioux City West to total 32 kills as a team. No individual stats were available for the Jackets. TJ is now 1-15 on the season. Underwood earned a home sweep on Tuesday after junior Elizabeth Jacobson slammed down 19 of the Eagles' 36 kills. Senior Delaney Ambrose dished out 25 assists, senior Grace Pierce blocked 3 shots, senior Sophia Fiedler totaled 9 digs, and senior Aaliyah Humphrey finished with 3 aces. AHSTW freshman Hallie Goodman dished out 20 assists, junior Delaney Goshorn totaled 10 kills, junior Megan Akers blocked 2 shots, and senior Grace Porter totaled 15 digs. Underwood is now 10-11 on the season, and AHSTW is 6-18. Trainor ran through Audubon on the road on Tuesday, finishing with 35 kills compared to just 17 for the Wheelers. Junior Haley Swanson dished out 22 assists and served 3 aces. Junior Ella Turax totaled 10 kills. Senior Carolyn Horton blocked 5 shots, and senior Delaney Simpson finished with 10 digs. Trainor is now 17-4 on the season. Glenwood fell in the 5-set thriller on the road after the Knights finished with 15 more kills. Junior McKenna Kohler dished out 22 assists, sophomore Maddie Roenfeld totaled 13 kills, sophomore Ilsa Kemmeling blocked 12 shots, and senior Delaney Holton collected 26 digs. Glenwood is now 11-18 on the season. Riverside fell in a battle of 2 of the top teams of the Western Iowa Conference on the road after committing 10 more kill errors than Missouri Valley. Sophomore Isla Richardson dished out 25 assists and served 4 aces. Senior Veronica Andrushin spiked down 13 kills. Sophomore Sophia Taylor dished out 3 assists, and junior Carly Henderson totaled 15 digs. Riverside is now 19-4 on the season. And our next article is under Hawkeye Football, and it's titled "Stevens Works to Give a Leg Up" by Steve Batterson. Drew Stevens is well aware of the impact kickers have had in University of Iowa football games against Michigan over the years. If needed, the Hawkeye freshman feels prepared to make some history of his own Saturday. "Those moments, that's what you live for as a kicker," Stevens said. 4 games into his college career, Stevens is just beginning to experience those moments at the collegiate level. After handling kickoffs in Iowa's first 2 games, Stevens added place-kicking responsibilities on game days to his workload 2 weeks ago and has been perfect since. In addition to connecting on all 6 of his point-after attempts, he has connected on each of his 4 field goal tries, including hitting from 51 yards on his 2nd field goal during the Hawkeyes' 27-10 win at Rutgers last Saturday. Stevens is ready to add to that resume when Iowa welcomes 4th-ranked Michigan to Kinnick Stadium at 11:05 a.m. on Saturday. "I have great confidence in myself and in the teammates around me to go out and get the job done," Stevens said. "I feel good with where things are at." Iowa's most recent victory over the Wolverines was won by a kick, a 33-yard field goal by Keith Duncan as time expired in 2016, that gave the Hawkeyes a 14-13 victory over 3rd-ranked Michigan. As thousands of fans spilled onto the Kinnick Stadium turf, Duncan made a dash to the opposite end of the stadium to celebrate a win that spoiled the Wolverines' 9-0 start to the season. Stevens has seen video of the game-winning kick. Working with the same kicking form coach who Duncan worked with in high school, Dan Orner, the North Augusta, South Carolina native, has heard about it from Duncan as well. "I've seen it on TVs around here. He makes the kick, and it's like, oh, we won this. I can do this. And I know what he's feeling," Stevens said. "I can handle this too." Duncan's walk-off field goal is the latest in a series of difference-making kicks in Hawkeye wins over the Wolverines. Iowa has beaten the Wolverines just 4 times ever and hadn't won a game in the series since 1962 when Tom Nickel made a difference in 1981. Nickel connected on 3 field goals that allowed Iowa to win a 9-7 game at Ann Arbor in 1981, a victory that helped Iowa earn its first Big Ten Conference championship and Rose Bowl berth under Hayden Fry. 4 years later, Rob Houtland kicked 4 field goals to give Iowa a win in one of the program's most historic games. In a matchup between teams ranked number 1 and number 2 in the country, Houtland hit a 29-yard field goal as time expired to give the top-ranked Hawkeyes a 12-10 victory over the Wolverines that also helped send Iowa to a Big Ten title and Rose Bowl berth. In 1990, former United Township High School standout Jeff Skillett connected on an extra point following a 1-yard touchdown run by Paul Kujawa with 1 minute 9 seconds remaining, and John Derby intercepted an Elvis Gerback pass on the ensuing series in a 24-23 win at Ann Arbor that ultimately allowed the Hawkeyes to earn a piece of the Big Ten title. Nate Kading hit 3 field goals in the Hawkeyes' 30-27 win over the Wolverines at Kinnick Stadium in 2003, and Daniel Murray connected on 3 field goals in a 30-28 win over Michigan and Iowa City in 2009. Before Duncan kicked his game winner in 2016, Mike Meyer did the same to beat the Wolverines in 2013. He hit from 34 yards with 6 minutes and 2 seconds remaining to give the Hawkeyes a 24-21 victory. An Iowa kicker also helped send Michigan's most recent win at Kinnick Stadium into overtime in 2005. Kyle Schlitcher connected from 32 yards as time expired in regulation to tie the game at 17, and then hit from 28 yards in overtime to give Iowa a lead that didn't stick when Jerome Jackson scored on a 1-yard carry in the Wolverines' 23-20 win. Stevens has talked with Kading and is part of a text group with Duncan, who he said has helped prepare him for the successful start to his college career. "He has so much knowledge. He has given me some advice about the wind patterns at Kinnick and things like that," Stevens said. "He's helped me with ways to stay calm. I do deep breaths to slow the adrenaline down a bit, just to be ready to go out and kick. That hasn't been an issue." Stevens enrolled last January and improved consistency this fall following inconsistent work last spring. "I'm not trying to diss him because he should have been in high school, but he's made a big jump since then," Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said. "I think that's the important part. That's, I think, attributed to his personality, his work ethic. He's done it and worked hard at it, and it's starting to show right now." Ferentz said the competition between Stevens and Aaron Blom, who hit one of 4 field goal tries in Iowa's first 2 games, continues on a daily basis in practice, something he doesn't mind. "We're talking about 2 young guys, 2 inexperienced guys," Ferentz said. "I've said we expect some ups and downs, some bumps in the road at that spot, and hopefully we can just keep pushing forward. This is what Stevens plans. He welcomed the opportunity to become the Hawkeye starter. All I've been doing is working for it, and to finally get it, it was a good feeling," Stevens said. "I wasn't quite as nervous as I expected. I was a little shocked that when I got out there I wasn't nervous at all." He has found the experience somewhat different than what he anticipated. "The noise, it just kind of blends together. I don't really notice it," Steven said. "In high school, I could hear specific voices and recognize people. That doesn't happen here." That's among the reasons Stevens continues to think about the possibilities as he prepares for Michigan. Every day, you think about making the deciding kick," Steven says. "You work to be ready for it." Moving on to our next article in the college soccer category, it's titled "Top-Ranked Iowa Western Reavers Edge by Warriors," by Austin Heinen. We have a photo of a man kicking a soccer ball with the caption, "IFN," I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, it's spelled E-Y-I-F-E-H-N, "IFN 4-4 scored the game-winning goal against Indian Hills on Wednesday afternoon. Number 1 Iowa Western men's soccer needed double overtime to defeat in-state rival Indian Hills 4-3 to remain undefeated on the season. "They just find a way," Reavers coach Mike Brown said. "They grind and they're resilient. We have to find a way to clean up our defense, but the resilience and selflessness, commitment, and honesty in this group, I love it. We find ways to get the job done. Now we just have to keep finding ways to get better, because we're still the team to beat." The Reavers broke the scoreless tie in the 19th minute with a goal from Eduardo Deglinicent to go up 1-0. The teams would battle back and forth and occasionally create opportunities, but ultimately the teams would go into the break with the Reavers leading. The 1-0 score was upheld until Ibrahim Kondi, in the 72nd minute, made it 2-0 in favor of the Reavers, which seemingly put the game out of reach. But the game was just heating up as Galder Gaztelu Itur scored in the 73rd minute to bring the Warriors back within a goal. Gustavo Marquez then booted into a 75th minute penalty kick to tie the game at 2-2. A 78th minute goal by Junior Casillas put the Reavers back up 3-2. But, in the 83rd minute, Indian Hills tied the game at 3-3 as Marquez scored his 2nd of the day. The Reavers got 3 late shots on goal, but they couldn't get any past the keepers, so the teams went to overtime, and after a scoreless first overtime, we went to a 2nd overtime. After dominating the possession time in both overtime periods, IFN 4-4 kicked in the game winner in the 105th minute to escape the Warriors' upset bid. "It was an easy finish," 4-4 said. "I got a good cross pass and I just put it in. It's probably one of the biggest goals I've scored. This was a difficult game, but we stayed together and worked together, and we got the result we deserved, a win." The win marks the program's 25th consecutive win. Iowa Western will play at number 11 Iowa Lakes on Wednesday at 1 p.m. I'll now go into the sports briefs by Peter Huguenin. The first is titled "Lewis Central Falls to Sioux City." Lewis Central Swimming lost to Sioux City in a road duel on Tuesday despite winning 6 races 55-39. The Titans won the 200-yard medley relay with a team of Hannah Steinmetz, Kylie Brown, Sydney Collins, and Mia Hansen. The team finished with a time of 1 minute 58.06 seconds. Brown won the 200 individual medley with a time of 2 minutes 17.82 seconds and the 500 freestyle with a time of 5 minutes and 21.97 seconds. Claire Crilly won the 50 freestyle with a 26.37 seconds. Collins won the butterfly with a 1 minute and 2.73 seconds and the breaststroke with a 1 minute and 10.01 seconds. Our next one is titled Lynx Jackets Battle at Conference. Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson battled at the Missouri River Athletic Conference golf tournament on Tuesday, where AL finished in 6th place and TJ earned 7th. The Lynx shot a 428 as a team, and the Jackets finished with a 445. Sioux City Helan won the meet with a 317. Steven Stengel led Abraham Lincoln with a score of 105, Jordan Hargrave scored 107, Tuckett Hates and Camden Wyant both carded a 108, and Jameson Vanderveld and Connor Price totaled 112. Jace Munt led Thomas Jefferson with a 104, Kendall Bell shot a 103, Derek Runyons finished with a 115, and Jacob Leslie scored 123. And our final sports brief, Lynx Trojans run at Denison. Abraham Lincoln and Tri-Center Cross Country competed at the Denison Schleswig invite on Tuesday. Senior Abby LaSalle led the Lynx girls with an 8th place finish after running the race in 21 minutes 39.57 seconds, and Cody Smith led the boys with a 12th place finish and time of 18 minutes 15.58 seconds. Tri-Center sophomore Quincy Schneckloth led the girls with a 34th place finish and time of 23 minutes and 38.63 seconds, and Sean McGee finished 31st with a time of 19 minutes and 12.48 seconds. In the girls' race, Abraham Lincoln placed 6th as a team with 163 points, and Tri-Center finished in 10th with 224 points. Harlan won the meet with 55 points. Harlan's Lindsay Sonderman won the race with a 19 minute and 23.84 seconds. In the boys' race, Abraham Lincoln finished 6th as a team with 166 points, and Tri-Center took 9th with 210. Woodbine won the team race with 51 points after Landon Bengen won with a time of 16 minutes and 16 seconds. Our next article under College Football Picks by Ralph D. Russo. For a few ranked teams, the first month of the season was all about home sweet home. Number 4 Michigan, number 9 Oklahoma State, and number 15 Washington will play their first road games of the season this weekend. The Cowboys have a big one in the Big 12 against number 16 Baylor. The Wolverines and Huskies face unranked but potentially formidable conference foes in their first road trips. Here are the 5 most intriguing games of the weekend with lines from FanDuel Sportsbook. Number 18 Oklahoma at TCU. Oklahoma was upset last week by Kansas State, which found more than a few holes in Brent Venables' defense. Now the Sooners face a TCU offense that is averaging 8.1 yards per play. This game should give us an idea of just how wild the Big 12 race will be this season. Line Oklahoma by 6.5, pick Oklahoma 38-28. Number 15, Washington at UCLA. QB Michael Penix Jr. leads the nation with 347 yards passing per game and has thrown only one interception as the Huskies have surged into the rankings in their first season under coach Kalen DeBoer. Let's see how it plays in Pasadena against the Bruins, whose 4-0 start includes only one victory against a Power 5 team, and that was last week against winless Colorado. Line, Washington by 2.5, pick UCLA 31-28. Number 22, Wake Forest at number 23, Florida State. There's a top 10 game in the Atlantic Coast Conference, but this one makes the list because it will provide a status check on Florida's state revival. The Seminoles are ranked for the first time in 4 years, but staying there will be tough with consecutive games against Wake, number 10 North Carolina State, and number 5 Clemson. Line, Florida State by 6.5, pick Wake Forest 34-33, upset special. Number 7 Kentucky at number 14 Mississippi. The Rebels have been impressive in a 4-0 start, but it has come against 3 FBS opponents who are a combined 5-7 and an FCS team. QB Will Levis and the Wildcats will provide by far their toughest tent. Kentucky has its highest ranking since finishing the season 6th in 1977. Line, Ole Miss by 6.5, pick Mississippi at 27-23. Number 4, Michigan at Iowa. The Wolverines tore through the Hawkeyes in the Big Ten championship game last year, but Kinnick figures to be a challenging place for QB J.J. McCarthy to make his first road start. The Iowa defense has yet to allow more than 5 yards per play in a game and has scored 3 touchdowns. Line, Michigan by 10.5. Pick, Michigan 20-13. Other top 25 games, Utah State at number 19, BYU, minus 24. Star WR Gunner Romney, lacerated kidney, is set to make his season debut. BYU 42-14. Number 1, Georgia, minus 28 at Missouri. Bulldogs have won 9 of 10 since the Tigers joined the SEC. Georgia 45-10. Number 2, Alabama, minus 17 at number 20, Arkansas. Tide have won 15 straight in the series. Only 4 have been one-possession games, which is as many as has been decided by at least 40 points. Alabama 42-17. Rutgers at number 3, Ohio State, minus 40.5. Buckeyes are 8-0 against the Scarlet Knights, average margin 42.5. Ohio State 56-14. Number 9, Oklahoma State, plus 1.5. At number 16, Baylor. Cowboys QB Spencer Sanders totaled 7 interceptions as OSU split 2 games with the Bears last season. Oklahoma State 23-21. Number 10, North Carolina State, plus 6.5. At number 5, Clemson. Could be a soggy one in Death Valley. Clemson 20-16. Arizona State, plus 26.5 at number 6, Southern California. How much fight is left in the Sun Devils? USC, 45-21. Northwestern at number 11, Penn State, minus 25.5. Since beating Nebraska in Dublin, Wildcats have lost to Duke, an FCS school, and an MAC school. Penn State, 38-10. Oregon State at number 12, Utah, minus 10.5. Utes' pass defense has been stifling, allowing 5.1 yards per pass and only 2 TD throws. Utah 28-16. Stanford at number 13, Oregon, minus 17.5. Cardinal are banged up along the offensive line and allowing more than 4.3 sacks per game. Oregon 42-20, best bet. Number 17, Texas A&M, plus 3.5 at Mississippi State. Bulldogs have won 5 of 8 against the Aggies. Mississippi State 26-24. Purdue at number 21, Minnesota, minus 11.5. Status of Boilermakers QB Aiden O'Connell, undisclosed injury, is uncertain. Minnesota 31-17. Georgia Tech at number 24, Pittsburgh, minus 23.5. First game for the Yetlow Jackets after coach Jeff Collins was fired. Pitt 38-13. Texas Tech at number 25, Kansas State, minus 7.5. Wildcats have won 6 straight in the series and haven't lost to the Red Raiders in Manhattan since 2008. Kansas State 31-21. Our next article, titled Early Look at World Cup in Qatar by Steve Douglas. We have a photo of Cristiano Ronaldo yelling and holding his arms up with the caption, Portugal's Cristiano Ronaldo reacts after missing a scoring chance during the UEFA Nations League soccer match between Portugal and Spain on Tuesday. The 37-year-old hopes to finally reach a World Cup final this year. A last chance for Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo. Kylian Mbappe back on the biggest stage of all, Brazil bidding for a record-extending 6th title. One of the most eagerly anticipated World Cups in memory, as much for off-the-field reasons as those on it, is just around the corner in Qatar, and excitement is building after the qualification period was wrapped. 32 teams, 64 matches, 29 days. The first World Cup in the Middle East. The tournament starts on November 20th, and the final is set for December 18th. Here's a few things to watch when the tournament gets going in the smallest country ever to host a World Cup. Top teams. Brazil, number 1 in FIFA ranking. Neymar, Vinicius Jr., and the rest of the flair-filled Selecao are peaking at the right time. Is the first World Cup title since 2002 on the horizon? Belgium, number 2. The golden generation is gradually breaking up, but there's still Kevin De Bruyne leading the Belgian charge. Argentina, number 3. No World Cup title since the days of the great Diego Maradona. This will be the first World Cup since his death in November 2020, and Argentina is improving, with Messi still at its core. France, number 4, the defending champions, still the country with the most depth to its squad despite a growing injury list. Now with Mbappe and Karim Benzema, leading the attack, no team has retained its World Cup title since Brazil in 1962. England, number 5, semi-finalist at the World Cup in 2018, finalist at the European Championship in 2021. Soccer's most underperforming national team is trending in the right direction at major tournaments but is winless in its last 6 competitive games. Big stars. Lionel Messi, Argentina. The 7-time World Player of the Year might have been saving his 35-year-old legs for one last push at a World Cup winner's medal that, to many, would solidify him as soccer's greatest player. Cristiano Ronaldo, Portugal. He has won the European Championship, but the leading scorer in men's international soccer hasn't played in a World Cup final, let alone won one. He's 37 years old now. Make the most of him while you can. Kylian Mbappe, France. The star of the last World Cup at the age of 19, and he's only getting better. The speedy striker could match Brazil great Pelé in being a champion at his first two World Cups. Kevin De Bruyne, Belgium. Widely regarded as the world's best midfielder, his driving runs are among the best sights in soccer. Belgium just has to hope he arrives healthy. Neymar, Brazil. Often overshadowed by Mbappe and Messi at Paris Saint-Germain, while still the main man works for Brazil. Watch out for tricks and flicks and some histrionics, too. How it works. Get ready for a feast of soccer. There are 8 groups of 4 teams, with the top 2 advancing to the 16-team knockout stage. There will be 4 games back-to-back per day for most of the first 2 sets of group games, then simultaneous kickoffs for the last 2 games in each group. There will be no break for the knockout stage, which begins the day after the group stage ends. The first day without soccer comes on December 7th, the 17th day of competition. And onto our last article on the sports page today, Reavers Push Past Warriors by Austin Heinen. Number 8 Iowa Western women's soccer earned its 6th straight win after a big conference win over Indian Hills on Wednesday afternoon. The Reavers beat the Warriors 3-1. It was another good team performance, Reavers coach Adam Sanchez said. I thought we came in ready for the match and the girls showed they really wanted this game. My only critique of the girls was just not capitalizing on more of our opportunities. If you create scoring chances against a good team, you have to put them away. It's great that we created those chances, we just have to be a bit more efficient in terms of finishing them. The Reaver offense came out firing early and often, and despite some early misses, Marta Yopis scored a 28th-minute goal to break the ice for the Reavers and take a 1-0 lead, which was how the score would hold to halftime. The first was a relief for us, Yopis said. We were close so many times before then, and it was a bit frustrating, but when we finally got one to go in, we felt a lot better and settled down. Within the first 10 minutes of the second half, Hannah Schimmer booted in a 52nd-minute goal to give the Reavers a goal lead and a huge insurance marker that would ice the game. Lexi Cook then knocked in an 83rd-minute goal to give the Reavers a late 3-0 lead, but Abby Bailey would boot in an 86th-minute goal for the Warriors to spoil the shutout bid for the Reavers. Iowa Western will play at Iowa Lakes on Wednesday at 3:30 p.m. in Spencer. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, September 29th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Elena from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.